Welcome back to the program. As is the case in most of our political debates in this country, we never seem to understand context. As immigration reform is once again front and center, the debate about immigration from Mexico should be about more than just numbers and citizenship. We are in fact dealing with a nation going through a transition. And while it has been widely reported that Mexico is changing, that it is sprouting greater economic prosperity, greater democracy, and less violence, its blood-soaked tide is still very powerful and still pulls in many into its wake. One of those has been our guest, Alfredo Corchado. Alfredo Corchado is the Mexican bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. He's a Nieman Fellow, and he's the author of a new memoir entitled Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Alfredo Corchado, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Jeff.
Great to have you here. You originally, when you went to Mexico initially, it really was to cover immigration. That was what you thought you were going to be writing about for a long time.
That's right. My dream was really to go back to Mexico and find a way to tell the other stories, whether it was culture, music, especially immigration. I come from a family of immigrants. I myself am an immigrant. So I thought it was important to try to give that issue a voice. And obviously, it became much more than that.
When did you realize that it was impossible to really report on Mexico, to cover the country in terms of all the things that were going on, without looking very seriously at the violence, the drug wars, and these drug cartels?
I think after the 2000 election, Vicente Fox, as you recall, had just been elected. It was the first opposition government in 71 years, the National Action Party. And there was a sense that Mexico was about to take off, become what many believe, you know, it has the potential to become a great country. And suddenly you see things spiraling down. And like it's almost like the underbelly of Mexico was exposed. And you realize just how deep, penetrating, corruption-wide, it just permeated many of the agencies. It felt almost like an institution. Corruption was an institution in Mexico. And I think that's one. As a reporter, you said, you know, we have really missed the story in the 90s. We looked the other way. We focused a lot on the economic recovery of the country and the Chiapas uprising. But this was there. And it just made you understand how it really was a war within the government. I mean, the corruption was such that sometimes you didn't know who the bad guys are, who the good guys are. And to this day, I mean, that's still very much the situation.
How much was there a nexus between the political transition the country was beginning to go through in the 2000 election and what we were seeing happen with respect to the drug wars and the violence?
I mean, I think right after 2000, you saw the power shift. I think, you know, for 71 years, the long ruling regime that governed Mexico for 71 years really control the country with an ironclad power. I mean, suddenly you saw that that shifted to states. Suddenly it was the governors who were in charge, and the governors were obviously overwhelmed by the presence of organized crime. And that's when you started seeing the vacuum that was left behind. And you saw the face of the monster, you know, rear its head.
It's interesting that you talk about when you started covering Mexico, your mother, I guess it was, said, do anything you want, just don't cover the drug wars.
Yes, that's true. We were born in Durango, San Luis de Cordero, a small little town in the northern part, right bordering Chihuahua. And then we later moved to California, lived much of our lives in the San Joaquin Valley. But when I went to El Paso, we moved to El Paso, I went back to school. And you come face to face with organized crime, and you see, you know, what that means. I mean, a lot of shady characters. We had a small little cafe, a little restaurant, two blocks from the border, and you see your customers, and you know, they didn't really ask questions, but you knew that there was something going on. Something, they were moving stuff that wasn't just legal merchandise. So oftentimes, when my parents got a sense that my passion really was in journalism, they said, look, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. Just stay away from these guys. And one line that my father often repeated to me was, drug cartels do not know the word or the meaning of forgiveness. You do anything across them, they will never forgive you. And that always stayed registered in my mind. But again, the violence begins early 2000s. The journalism industry is suddenly going through its very difficult period because of the economic crisis. We went from a bureau at the Dallas Morning News from 12, 13 people to one eventually, and that was me. So it's not like I had a choice. You know, I couldn't really look the other way. I mean, you had to cover this. But I think it also became somewhat, I guess, an obsession in a sense of trying to figure out what went wrong in Mexico, what happened to Mexico. And the more you dug, the more you got into it, the more you realized, holy cow, you know, this is much, much greater than, the problem is much, much deeper than we ever imagined.
And one of the things you talk about, and we forget in the individual stories about violence, the sheer scope of it and for how long it was going on, that 80,000 people have been killed or disappeared as a result of this drug violence.
Yeah, I mean, this is in a six-year period. Oftentimes people think of this as Calderon, the former president, as his war, but this really happened before Calderon. I think Calderon was the one who said, you know what, enough is enough, let's do something. At the end of his period, the numbers were something like 70,000 kill and 27 to 30,000 people disappear. I think realistically, I mean, we're talking about more than 100,000 people either kill or disappear. And it's hard to say, well, this was a fight between the good and bad, you know, the gangs and government authorities, et cetera, because there were a lot of innocent people that who were also caught in the crossfire. So, you know, today you cover Mexico, and it's really a traumatized nation. That's really what you're reporting on.
Of course, it was impossible to cover this without looking at the activity that was going on this side of the border.
It's always, you ask Mexicans, and they will blame the U.S. I mean, blame the U.S. for the guns, for the drug demand. But the thing that I think has surprised me in my 20 years of reporting in Mexico is also finding how people are also blaming themselves a lot more. Blaming themselves for not having ever really taken the time to try to build a rule of law that actually works, and shaming their authorities with this, you know, new thing called social media. I mean, it's something that I think gives a lot of people hope that for the first time you see Mexicans really putting people in the spot and trying to hold the government accountable, by using Twitter, using Facebook. And I think that's been quite effective. I mean, the conviction rate in Mexico is still very, very low. But you see more and more Mexicans throughout the country using tools to try to get people to respond, get governments to at least respond to questions and to allegations. And that's very healthy for Mexico.
Of course, most of these crimes have not been solved, as you talk about, that most of this violence goes without investigation or certainly without any kind of solution to these crimes.
There's always a lot of, we're going to get to the bottom of this. But at the end, I mean, it's less than 5%. Some people say less than 2% of all crimes are ever solved or people are convicted. And that, I think, is really gets to the heart of what's wrong with Mexico. There are many, 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 many young kids, you know, who look at the numbers. They glorify the whole drug cartel culture. And they say, well, you know what? I can do that. I'll probably never get convicted. Yes, you know, he or she may be killed early in life, but during that time, they may make a lot of money. They may write a song about them, and they're glorified. It's really pathetic. I mean, 2%, 5% people being convicted. I mean, that's really, I think, the biggest problem that Mexico faces. That's the biggest challenge.
How sophisticated are these cartels?
They're very sophisticated. I mean, they... Sometimes, you know, Jeff, when you look at the history of the cartels, it's really a group of farmers from the state of Sinaloa who to this day have managed to keep Mexico hostage. They're very sophisticated in human intelligence. They realize, you know, where the weak spots are. They get to them, they co-opt them, very much like the government. I guess one example is the Gulf Cartel, which operates along the Tamaulipas-Texas border. in the 1990s, the U.S. the Mexican government sent some of their elite troops to United States for training, and the idea was let them come back, train, go after the Mexican drug cartels, specifically the Gulf cartel, which posed a big threat. The leader of that group says, you know what? How much money are you guys making? He makes direct contact with one of them. They give the money, the price, and he says, well, I'll double that. Suddenly this guy has an elite paramilitary unit made of 35 people, and thus begins the growth of the Zetas, who are now probably the most dangerous group in Mexico operating.
Talk a little bit about how this has changed over time, that different groups have really had more power at different periods of time.
That's a great question. I mean, when I started covering this, it was really maybe three major cartels: the Gulf cartel, Sinaloa cartel, the Juarez cartel. There were other smaller, you know, franchises, if you will. Today, I think the biggest problem that the new administration of Enrique Peña Nieto has is there's a sense that maybe the PRI can go back to the old days and try to negotiate a pact. Find some kind of accommodation. The problem is, who do you negotiate with? I mean, the latest numbers I hear are there are more than 70 cartels operating. So that really changes the whole dynamic. And it also changes the violence. I mean, for the longest time, cities like Ciudad Juarez, right across El Paso, Texas, cities like Nuevo Laredo, across Laredo, Texas, were known to be the most dangerous cities. It's like a moving target now. I mean, Juarez is a lot safer, but other places in Mexico have become much more dangerous. So, you know, it moves and moves, and I think the sense is that from the new government is give us some time, let's downplay the expectations, and maybe within a year we can kind of get a better handle on things.
From your own personal perspective, talk about your own journey into the heart of darkness of all of this and the dangers that it posed for you.
Well, there were four threats. The last one came with the help of a U.S. investigator who, someone very close to me, and said, listen, we just got word that three journalists are on a hit list, and you're one of them. And I took that very seriously. And I ended up eventually leaving Mexico for a year. And it was during that time when I finally decided, you know, I do want to get back to Mexico. I miss Mexico. Mexico, I still believe or feel, is my homeland as much as the United States is. And that's when I started thinking about Midnight in Mexico. But it's something that, you know, you're in Mexico and you're constantly watching over your shoulder, and then you're in the United States and you feel the sense of all is well. My personal sense or belief is that as long as I have a U.S. passport, that offers me a protection that a lot of my colleagues in Mexico lack. It's not that I'm more courageous or more savvy or anything like that. It's just that I have the protection that they don't have. I mean, I have a government that I want to believe, and it's proven in the past, that if I'm in some kind of danger, they will stick their necks out for me, and they will issue a statement and tell people to back off. And that's something that colleagues in Mexico do not have.
And what is it like for them, or is it even possible for them, to cover this violence, to cover these drug wars, without putting themselves in very serious personal danger?
It's an incredible question, and it really gets to the heart of what's going on in Mexico today as far as journalists. Many of them, you know, live in regions that have been really hard hit, where they have to live, abide by the rules of the cartels. They've been forced to censor. Many have been kidnapped. I mean, the numbers vary according to agencies. The Committee to Protect Journalists says more than 44 people have been killed, journalists have been killed. Reporters Without Borders puts the number at more than 100. You know, the reality is that there are zones, regions in Mexico that are really have been, I guess, overshadowed by silence. There's very little information. Yet, on the other hand, you have another generation of younger journalists in places like Mexico City who are really learning the, I guess, the art of journalism, and they're really holding government accountable. So it's a mixed bag. You know, you have these two journalisms in Mexico. One gives you a sense of what this country can be, and the other one just points out to the challenges that remain ahead.
Talk a little bit about the degree to which Calderon exacerbated the problem, the violence, by virtue of his drug wars.
If you talk to officials on both sides of the border, they will say, you know, Calderon had very little choice but to do this. I mean, he once gave an analogy to President Bush right before Calderon was still president-elect, went to visit D.C., and said, you know, I thought it was cancer, what I was facing with. But once we opened the body, we realized that the cancer had moved to every part of the body. And it wasn't just a matter of going in, detecting it, taking it out, removing the tumor. You had to start from scratch. And so people, you know, applaud him for making the decision, praise him for having the courage to do that. But yet a lot of officials, a lot of critics will say he had no plan. He had no real strategy. He constantly improvised, and the result, again, is, you know, over 100,000 people kill or disappear.
What is the connection, if any, between the economic well-being of Mexico and the economic growth of Mexico and stemming some of this violence and dealing with the drug wars?
That's a million-dollar question. I mean, I think a lot of people, a lot of cynics, skeptics, including myself, you know, I travel throughout Mexico, and I see a lot of construction going on. And oftentimes I wonder, you know, just to what degree is this drug money, you know, dirty money? Not to say that everything in Mexico is dirty money. I think there's a lot of legitimate businesses. There's a lot of foreign investment that comes in. But it does, I mean, one number I saw was that something like 3% of the GDP is made up of dirty money. So it does definitely have a huge impact. Some numbers have it at 500,000 people are somehow employed directly or indirectly by the drug trade. So it's a big part of the overall economy.
The corollary of that is that the more the economy starts to grow, the easier it is in many ways to wash a lot of this money.
To wash a lot of money, and also the more infrastructure you built in Mexico, the concern is the easier it is to transport drugs from one part of the country into the United States. That is the reality. But in the end, you know, until Mexicans are able to really build the rule of law, institutions that work, until you get that conviction rate down, I mean, higher, it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, you know, you're going to have some kind of contraband that's going to create problems for Mexico as a country.
How does Mexico begin to create that rule of law, create that legal infrastructure?
It's been painful, I tell you, but it's if there's anything that gives you a sense of hope, is that in the darkest times in Mexico, you've also seen the best of Mexicans. And you know, one example is Ciudad Juárez. For the longest time, one of the most dangerous, murderous cities in Mexico, if not in the Americas. And you see there the country, a city in transition. You see communities that are finally building communities, as one father told me, with the blood of our children. He's a father of one of the teens, 15 teens who were massacred during a birthday celebration in February of 2010. But families like them, I mean, they banded together. They've worked with authorities, even though there's not much trust, but they just keep showing up, trying to hold them accountable. They actually took some of the suspects to jail, convicted them. You know, there's signs like that kind of leave you believing that Mexicans can do this on their own. It's not going to happen overnight. I mean, it's going to take a long time. But you see the initiative underway, and I think it bodes well for the country.
How do the issues of immigration, as well as the economic well-being of the U.S., play into some of these issues in Mexico? We saw a trickle of immigration happen when things were tough here. we're starting to see a change in that. How is that affecting immigration? How is it affecting these drug-related violence issues?
Well, it's becoming incredibly dangerous for people to go back and forth. I mean, not just because of U.S. Immigration policy, but I think also because of how difficult, how dangerous it is along the U.S.-Mexico border. Now you have drug cartel organizations who control the patterns, who control the smuggling routes, and that just makes it that much more dangerous, especially for Central Americans. On the Mexican side, what's interesting is that the birth rate has gone down from 7 to 2, so there are less Mexicans who are trying to get across into the United States because of the lack of jobs in the U.S., but also because of the danger. The Central Americans, people from El Salvador, Honduras, have it much, much tougher. And until you return to some kind of legal circularity, I think you're either going to see more bodies found in the deserts of South Texas or Arizona. But it's not going to stop people from trying to get in. I mean, in spite of the problems, in spite of the danger that lurks along the U.S.-Mexico border.
What does the new Mexican regime and the new Mexican president think that they can do about these issues? What is their plan?
President Peña Nieto has been, I think, very smart so far in trying to downplay the expectations, in telling Mexicans, yes, it's a problem. Yes, my priority is to try to bring down the violence, but give me at least a year to try to do this. So I think Mexicans are willing to give him some time. In the meantime, let's focus on the economy and let's try to, understand how great Mexico is. It's been a very, I think, effective campaign, but it's also fraught with a lot of concerns. I mean, how do you tell a country that's lost more than 100,000 people and a country where you still see the same kind of level of violence? How do you suddenly tell them, hey, we're changing the storyline, nothing really happened here, let's move on, let's turn the page? I think, especially after 12 years of opposition rule in Mexico, I think as a journalist, that's really where the big story comes next. I mean, that's really where the challenge is. How much has Mexico changed? How much has Mexican civil society changed? And can they hold the new accountable?
It's also complicated by virtue of something you talked about earlier, which is the degree to which so much of this is not reported because of the state of journalism in Mexico right now. And it's the old, if the tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it. If this violence continues and it is not appropriately reported, what's the impact of that?
We see that every day in a place like Nuevo Laredo. They have elections coming up in July of this year. I mean, just in a few weeks, there's very little being reported. It's a kind of an interesting city because the opposition party there, the PAN, has a chance of beating out the PRI. But there's been so little reporting that oftentimes, as a foreign correspondent, I mean, it's your responsibility to get there and to try to tell stories that local residents don't know very little about, or the rest of the country.
Is there any progress being made with respect to journalists in Mexico being able to report on some of this?
Absolutely. I mean, maybe American listeners won't know, but three of the Pulitzer winners this year, three of the Pulitzers went to Mexican reporters. One of them, Alejandra Chanik, helped the New York Times win the Pulitzer for the uncovering investigation into Walmart. And the amazing thing is she spent more than a year testing Mexico's new transparency laws and actually going in there and uncovering all the corruption and the accommodations between Walmart and dirty politicians. So it's this new generation of reporters, I think, gives Mexicans a lot of hope for the future.
Alfredo Corchado, his book is Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Alfredo, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Jeff, my pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.